James Croft is a humanist activist and public speaker who advocates for human rights. He is a Cambridge and Harvard graduate and is currently studying for his doctorate in the philosophy of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, with a particular interest in how the arts promote ethical and existential development. He describes himself as being raised on Shakespeare, Sagan, and Star Trek. James is a committed humanist and a humanist celebrant who believes that society is desperately in need of living communities dedicated to human flourishing and freedom. Tonight, he'll be talking about humanism in Ferguson and beyond. Given the recent developments of yet another police shooting of an unarmed African-American teenager, this time here in Madison, Wisconsin, this issue could not be more important or relevant. Please welcome James Croft.
We have to shake hands. Is that a formal thing? Good evening, everybody. That was an awesome response. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for that. How do you feel? Good? I feel nervous, to be honest. Whenever anyone finds out that you do a lot of public speaking for a living, they always tend to ask, do you get nervous? And I will always answer, no. Especially if I'm on a date. It seems more kind of cool and composed to say that I never get nervous. But that's generally true. I'm usually so excited to speak to an audience like this that I very, very rarely get nervous. Nervousness is usually the last thing I feel. But today I do feel nervous. And I'm nervous because I am a white English guy who is going to talk to you about race and racism in America. So I'm basically exactly the wrong person to talk to you about this. I mean, I'm not just white, I'm vampiric. You know, if I go out in the sun, I turn into a little pile of ash, and you have to scrape me into a grave so I rise again the next night. I haven't personally experienced the injustices and oppressions that I'm going to talk to you about today. So I want to start with a disclaimer. I am not a leader of the Black Lives Matter movement, which grew up in Ferguson, and which has been led by people of color, particularly young people of color, and particularly young women of color, from the start. I'm not here to represent that movement or as an authority on it. I speak for myself, and I'm here to tell you what I've seen and experienced as a humanist activist who moved to St. Louis at the end of June last year, and who was almost immediately swept up in a movement which energized my new city and soon spread across the country and the world. I speak from my own perspective as a white gay man, and I'll be speaking mostly to the white people in the audience, although I hope what I say will be relevant to everybody. I want to tell you why I think what's happening in St. Louis and in the country right now is important, and why anyone who considers themselves a humanist or a free thinker should drop everything else they're doing and get involved right now. Does that sound okay? Okay. So this is the story. I moved to St. Louis at the end of June to work at the Ethical Society of St. Louis, a humanist congregation in the suburbs of that Midwestern city. Here it is, with its distinctive spire. Our building is affectionately known in the area as the Witch's Hat, or at least I think it is affectionate. I hope so. On a bright day, when you enter the foyer, the sun streams in through the multicolored windows, casting rainbow patterns on the floor and streaking your body with colored light. When you move through the foyer and into the meeting hall, you're struck immediately by the sense of space, the seats which stretch out on either side, and the wide stage which beckons in front. Then, as you walk down that central aisle, as many couples have done during their wedding ceremonies, your eyes are drawn upward to where the great vaulted spire lifts into the sky. This is the Ethical Society of St. Louis, where I now work. Now, if it looks like a church, that's because in many ways it functions like one. We gather on Sunday for inspirational presentations and music. We host potlucks and trivia nights and dances. We march in rallies and try to be of service to our community. We recognize the turning of the seasons and mark important holidays. We have a wonderful youth group filled with kind of wacky kids. This is a candle lighting ceremony we do every holiday time around the Christmas period. This is someone celebrating what looks like pirate mustache Christmas Day
We marry people. We remember our friends when they die. We welcome babies into the world. In fact, I'm doing my first baby naming ceremony next month, and I am so excited. I've decided to call him James. Actually, I don't get to choose the name. But I did tell a friend of mine recently that I was about to do my first baby naming ceremony, and he said, "That's amazing! What are you going to call it?" And I was like, "No, darling. You're so pretty, but no." The position I'm training for is called ethical culture leader. That's our equivalent of clergy. And I will perform, when I'm trained, many of the same functions as the leader of a congregation in a traditional religion, except without a magic hat or magic underwear or any magic at all. My authority, if I have any, comes not from God, but from the trust the community puts in me to help us explore some of the biggest questions of human existence. Why are we here? What's going on? How should we live? Our community exists to provide a welcoming home for humanists, to inspire ethical living, to promote the equal dignity of all people. And on every Sunday, a member of our Sunday Ethical Education for Kids program stands on a box so they can see over the podium and reads a statement of our community's core values, which begins, "Every person is important and unique. Every person deserves to be treated fairly and kindly." That's why I left Boston and Harvard, where I studied for 7 years, and moved to St. Louis. Less than 2 months after I arrived, Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, was shot and killed by Darren Wilson, a white police officer. I was out of town at a meeting of the World Humanist Congress in Oxford, England, and I heard about the shooting and its aftermath, the protests and the sporadic violence and the police response on the news. The importance of what had happened did not hit me then. If I'm totally honest, while I was and remained horrified by the shooting, I was surprised at the reaction of the community. I thought, doesn't this happen all the time? Another black man killed by the police? And perhaps some of you have had a similar reaction. Then I went to a vigil for victims of police violence, which had been organized in response to Brown's shooting. Me and a small group of humanists went down to the campus of a local university, carefully lit our candles and shielding them from the wind, listened as person after person of color spoke about their mistreatment at the hands of the police. And behind them hung a banner of names listing black people unjustly killed by the police, and most of them I had never heard of. Because this is an issue which doesn't touch my life directly. The fact that it was happening to other people hadn't even registered with me. Then one young woman, a college-age, or perhaps a little older young woman, talked about a time when she was pulled over on the highway for no reason she could tell, and as she was pulling her car to the side of the road, thought to herself, "I hope I get out of this alive." And as she told that story, there were tears in her eyes. It hit me then, stronger than it has before, that I don't have to think like that. As a relatively affluent young white person who identifies and presents as male, with a charming British accent and a fairly mainstream, though fabulous, sense in fashion, I don't generally have to have any interactions with the police at all. I go through life hardly thinking about the police, except in situations when things go wrong, and then I feel comfortable calling on them to help me. While it's certainly possible that I could be the subject of abuse of power at the hands of police, as a gay man, that's perhaps more, I'm more vulnerable than some people, it's not something that's part of my everyday experience or part of my mindset. When I speak to the police, they call me, sir. They ask me how they can help. I'm not an immediate suspect. I'm a citizen to be protected and served. And that is the sort of experience that everybody should be able to expect from the police. No law-abiding person should fear the police, as a matter of course, and no one, including people who have committed crimes, should fear summary execution on the streets of our cities. No one should have to think, if they're pulled over on the highway, "I hope I get through this alive." that that was the common experience shared again and again at this small vigil. And I realized in that moment that I had become, to some extent, normalized to state violence against people of color. That thought I had when I heard the news of the shooting, doesn't this happen all the time, was evidence of that. Yes, this happens all the time. And that's why people were protesting. Because it happens all the time. Because so many people, people like me, read the news of shootings like that of Michael Brown and think, oh, that's sad, and turn the page. By the time I returned to St. Louis, two things were clear to me. First, that the protests which began immediately after his death were not going away. And second, that I and my community had to do something about it. If the humanist commitment to equal dignity is to have any meaning at all, then it absolutely has to mean that people of color can expect to live their lives in a way that the police recognize they matter as much as white lives do. So I began going to meetings with local activists and clergy who were part of what was quickly becoming a large and well-organized protest movement in the city. And through those meetings, I was connected with the movement, and it gave me many opportunities for activism. And I want to show you some photos I've taken at various protests and events to give you a sense of the scale of the movement and of its vibrancy and creativity and passion. The first thing I did was I walked in the first major national march in Ferguson. We began by the burnt-out Quick Trip, a convenience store which was destroyed in the violence in the first few days after the shooting. You may have seen images of that in the media. And then we marched together to the site of Brown's death. There were hundreds of people. That's a sort of 360 panorama shot. People chanting and singing and marching, holding all these banners. This is them traipsing down to where Michael Brown was killed. And by the time we reached the street where Brown was shot, the line of marchers stretched as far as I could see. And this is the memorial to Michael Brown, built by family, friends, and a shocked community. And on that, around it, on the ground, you could still see the bloodstains. You can see them in that photo. People stood in a ring around the little mound of flowers and toys and candles and messages and paid their respects to someone they had never met. Most of them. Later, the protests moved downtown. A call went out throughout the country to march on the seat of city government, and groups from all around America heeded it. We had religious groups and political groups, there's the socialists out there, and a small, proud contingent of humanists from the Ethical Society, which got bigger after we took that photo. They were all spread out throughout the crowd in lots of other different groups, too. And one of my strongest memories from the day is the image of this puppet with the hands up, don't shoot pose that has become popularized as a means of protest during the movement. And we got lucky and we were positioned behind the puppet as we were marching. And you can see our little flag and our symbol there as we were marching down to the State House. And these marches and rallies were extremely well organized and well managed. I want to stress that because some people may have gotten the idea through the news coverage that it was basically chaos all the time, and that is not true. There were moments of tension, there were some very small moments of violence, but most of it, in my judgment, was provoked by the police. And the vast majority of these protests were, and continue to be, because they continue to this day, completely peaceful and very carefully designed. I chose this picture because you can just about see on the image there that there is a website and a text message system to keep people informed of where everybody's going, and there were trained legal observers and street medics and marshals and water bottles for everybody, the whole deal. It was an extremely well-organized and continues to be a very well-organized protest campaign. I also did some work with local clergy. As a humanist and atheist, this sometimes made me uncomfortable. But the fact is that I work for a congregation. I aspire to fulfill many of the social functions of a clergy person. So organizing alongside local St. Louis area clergy seemed to make sense. I wanted to make clear that humanists and the non-religious do have something to say about issues of social justice. So I went to a lot of clergy planning meetings and worked in a lot of churches and learned from rabbis and priests and imams and sat in lots of prayer circles. These are images from one youth-led clergy-sponsored protest. The orange vests came to be the accepted street garb for clergy people, and I wore one more than once. This one, as we marched, blocked a few streets off from traffic, then gathered outside the St. Louis County Justice Center to chant and sing and make a lot of noise and also do a planned die-in where we lay on the ground for 4.5 minutes to represent the 4.5 hours that Michael Brown's body was left unattended in the street after he was killed. In this photo, this is another clergy protest I went to, which is the closest I probably got to being arrested, where we blocked a number of streets for a number of hours. And this one I didn't take, because you can actually see me in that one, not kneeling to pray in the middle of the street. My enthusiasm for interfaith activism only goes so far. So in addition to these on-the-ground protests, I began also to volunteer behind the scenes for jail support. At the height of the protest, so many people were being arrested that they established a 24/7 phone line staffed by volunteers like me, which you could call anytime you got arrested. People would write the number on their arms, and they still do. We would take your details and, if possible, arrange bail and a trip back home. And the sorts of calls we would get shocked me. These were often very young people, often people who had not been engaged in much activism before, teenagers and early 20-somethings. And frequently, they would report mistreatment by the police. They charged me with burglary because I ran and hid behind a building after they fired tear gas. They snatched me off the street and locked me in a van all day without charging me with anything. They rounded us up after we had dispersed. They targeted women to enrage the men. They dragged me out of my wheelchair. They beat me up. I've had a lot of physical abuse by police of protesters. Our bail runners were turned away from the jails, even though they had the money to get people out, on the flimsiest, like totally made up grounds. Our jail support office, where we literally sit and answer phones all night, was surveilled by undercover police. We would go out and say hello to them every time we saw them out there. Protesters were systematically denied public defenders on the grounds that because we had paid their bail, they clearly had enough money to afford a lawyer. Now, try and get your head around that one for a moment. It doesn't make any sense, but it was the stated policy for a while in some of our county jails that they wouldn't provide a public defender to people if we had paid their bail out of the charity money we had raised. Police misconduct was everywhere. They were overly aggressive, turning up in riot gear and armored cars at the slightest provocation. They fired rubber and wooden bullets into crowds of peaceful protesters, sometimes causing astonishing wounds. In one terrifying incident recorded by human rights observers from Amnesty International, including some of my personal friends, like my friend Rachel here, who's in the gas mask, a group of peaceful protesters were prevented from leaving an established sanctuary space as police fired tear gas canisters directly into the exit and entrance of the building, in violation of every fire regulation ever. Amnesty reported that their observers were targeted and recorded the incident from inside the coffee shop, tweeting images like this of protesters with red eyes and mucus streaming down their face as the gas progressively fills the room in the background. It was clear that in their eyes, in the eyes of the police, the protesters were the enemy. Not citizens, not people they had sworn to serve, not their employers, but the enemy. And for a while, I was pretty involved in protesting stuff like that. One particular day, I was up early in the morning to block some streets with some clergy colleagues, and then as I got back home in the evening, found another protest happening right outside my apartment. So I jumped out of the car, ran down the street, and joined in. And this I took at an intersection 2 blocks south of my apartment building, taken over by St. Louis and Ferguson Youth. A friend of mine who sometimes visits the Ethical Society was hit by a car during that protest. Purposefully drove into them. The last actual protest I went on was on Christmas Eve, almost 3 months ago now, a candlelit vigil in response to the death of Antonio Brown, another youth who was killed by police. It was held on the steps of the Cathedral Basilica of St. Louis during their midnight mass and was a call to peace. I said it was held on the steps, but actually it was held on the sidewalk. The cathedral staff came out and shooed us off the steps and called in the riot police, more than 40 of them. Yes, on Christmas Eve, one of the largest Catholic cathedrals in America decided to place a police line between itself and peaceful vigil keepers upholding the dignity of all people. I love this photo from that protest. White silence equals violence. And I realize now that I was silent for far too long. So why talk about all this at a free thought festival? Why is it important? What does it have to do with free thought? Well, firstly, it's important because it's not just happening in Ferguson. I'm sure I don't need to tell you that. The Department of Justice recently released a report into racism in the Ferguson Police Department, and it makes for horrifying reading, and it should act as a wake-up call to everybody. It catalogues a litany of abuses meted out by the police against Ferguson residents of colour, including unlawful arrests, explicitly racist behaviour, excessive use of force, the use of Ferguson residents as an effective ATM to pay the city's bills. One quote from the report: many officers appear to see some residents, especially those who live in Ferguson's predominantly African-American neighborhoods, less as constituents to be protected than as potential offenders and sources of revenue. As CNN reported, only African-Americans were bit by police dogs. And according to Attorney General Eric Holder, no alternative explanation except racial bias exists to explain this. Some of the discrepancies in charging and sentencing are so huge as to be chilling. One of the most disturbing: African Americans were the target of 95% of the city's charges of manner of walking in roadway. That's the same behavior which initiated the encounter which led to Michael Brown's death. That such an innocuous traffic stop could lead to the death of a person still seems outrageous to me. But seen in the context of that Department of Justice report, it's clear how it could happen. The report found that Ferguson police, and this is a quote, "force is routinely unreasonable and sometimes clearly punitive. Officers there were quick to escalate and come to rely on force in situations where it was not necessary." As CNN reported, Ferguson Police Department records suggest a tendency to use unnecessary force against vulnerable groups, such as people with mental health conditions or cognitive disabilities, and juvenile students. I can't help but think here of Anthony Hill, the unarmed, completely naked black man who was acting erratically and was shot and killed by a white officer in Atlanta on Monday of this week. This doesn't just happen in Ferguson. Ferguson is just where we've looked for it. I believe that if we investigate other police departments around the country, including those here in Madison, we will uncover a huge systemic problem. Is there anyone here willing to bet against that? This is a genuine question. Anyone want to stand up for their police department? No. So this matters. Because it is likely that in every city in the country, there are biases like this playing out, and the result is dead people of color. It's that simple. The second reason it matters, and why it particularly should matter to we freethinkers, is because there is an enormous culture of denialism around the problem of racism in America. A denialism which goes way beyond being unable to see your own privilege. Not being able to see privilege is bad enough. But there is something much more insidious going on here. You would think, for instance, that in the face of such a comprehensive and damning report from the Department of Justice of the United States of America, a report which essentially comes with the seal and sanction of the President of the United States, that even the most skeptical person would accept that Ferguson had a big problem with racism. But what was St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCullough's response to the report? No one is saying there haven't been instances of racial profiling and other profiling, but to suggest that somehow it's all that goes on out there, in fact, does a great disservice to everybody. You almost have to cry, right? That sort of reaction is very common. I know this because I've heard it from my white friends and colleagues and acquaintances. I've seen it all over Twitter and Facebook. I've received emails about it, and in one charmingly old-fashioned instance, a handwritten letter. And if you're a person of color, I imagine you hear it all the time. It's sort of an aggressive denial of the reality of racism in America. When you dig beneath the surface of that attitude, you quickly realize that it can only be sustained through a kind of extreme egotism and intellectual dishonesty. The argument, if there is an argument, behind such denialism goes something like this. Because this stuff doesn't happen to me, and because I've never seen it, therefore, it possibly cannot happen to anybody else. It doesn't fit my vision of how I would like to see the police, or my city, or my country, so it can't be true. It's the same sort of thinking, ultimately, that enables men to deny that sexism exists, and straight people deny that homophobia exists. Oh, I've played lots of League of Legends, I'm a gamer, and no one has been sexist to me. No one's ever called me a fag online, except as a joke. So the first thing I would urge you to do, if you want to be an ally and fight for freedom alongside other people, is learn how to listen to them and trust what they say about their own experiences. These things really happen. Deeper than this egotism, though, is the disturbing fact, and I think it is undeniably a fact, although an uncomfortable one, that many white people have bought into a set of extremely damaging cultural and social stereotypes about people of color. We have come to believe what our own racist myths tell us. We hear statistics like 95% of the city's charges of manner of walking in roadway were brought against people of color, and we think for a split second, well, maybe they walk all over the road more than other people. You think that happens sometimes? We read only African Americans were bit by police dogs, and part of us thinks, well, perhaps only African Americans deserve to be bit by police dogs. Perhaps they don't just act like upstanding white folks. Perhaps they're not like us, not as good. If you are white and you have never had a thought remotely like that, then you are a better person than I am. So here is why this is a freethinker's issue. Failing to check these thoughts when they pop into your head and failing to genuinely listen to the experiences of people around you who are telling you what happens regularly in their lives is a colossal failure of skepticism. If that's how we think, then we are not free thinkers. Prejudice is a prison of the mind, and we are locked in it. It is our duty, as people who aspire to see the world as it really is, to free ourselves from the mental shackles of racism. And fundamentally, this is a matter of dignity. The core value of humanism is a commitment to the equal worth and dignity of every person. That's the heart of humanism. The Black Lives Matter movement is a call on us to recognize and accept the people of color in the United States are not treated as fully dignified human beings. The criminal justice system, the world of work, the media, and the culture consider people of color in some way to be subhuman. Not, thankfully, in the same way as during the time of slavery and segregation, progress has been made, but in countless ways, in every sphere of life, the message is conveyed that black people are less worthy of ethical respect and concern than white people. Their lives do not matter as much as mine. And this is not a theory. And I say it not as an expression of white guilt, as has been suggested in comments on my blog posts about this. It is not because I am a race traitor, as I was called in emails I've received. I say this because it is an unavoidable social fact. An uncomfortable, challenging, dispiriting, disturbing, disgusting fact that in today's America, black lives do not matter as much as white lives. The system conveys this in a million ways. Even the microphone doesn't like it. And all you need to do is know that it's true is listen to what people of color tell you about their experiences. Do you want me to?
Yes.
Yes, sir. Anything you say.
I'm getting a little excited. One example of that which has struck with me was an event that we hosted at the Ethical Society in which a panel of black mothers talked about their experience of raising black sons. And their descriptions offer a window into a world that I, as a white man with no children, had never encountered before. And I want to share with you some of what these mothers said. For black mums, there's a time when your cute little boy gets to a certain height and is perceived as a threat. I'm so heart weary of our boys always fitting the description. I don't sleep until he gets home, said one mother of a 20-year-old son. I have not slept all night since my son was about 10 years old. You may not be like your best friend, like little boys who are not black boys. When you're out, no more than one boy. Three is a mob. Three is a gang. I don't know where we can move, where you don't have to take this. This is everywhere for you. It is very difficult to tell your child this is the world and it's ugly. Mommy, I just want to know how long this will last, asked one boy to his mother after being stopped on the street on his way home. He was 12 years old. And what did his mother feel compelled to answer in the society we have created? Forever. It will last forever. The racism that infects our criminal justice system and every other system in this country doesn't just manifest itself in overt acts of violence and discrimination. It asserts itself through thousands and thousands of small indignities, like the ones these mothers describe, which progressively affect the psyche and the soul. Death of a thousand cuts. We have to recognize, those of us who have freed ourselves from religious dogma, that we're subject to and captured by another dogma just as insidious. The dogma that we live in a post-racial, egalitarian society where you get what you deserve and what you work for. That is a lie. The contours of power and prejudice shape our society, shape ourselves, shape our very thoughts. And if any of us are going to think freely, we have to pierce the veil of our own privilege and see the truth. And that is what free thought is about. Pursuing uncomfortable truths. Daring to believe what the evidence tells you, even when you don't want to believe it. And the truth is, America is a deeply, thoroughly, despicably racist country. And many other countries are the same. I don't want to believe that. I moved here because I believed in this country and what it could be. I wish it wasn't true, but it is true. And we free thinkers, we who exult in pursuing the truth, need to recognize that. But it doesn't have to be like this. Racism is not our fault. We didn't create the system we're living in, but it is our responsibility. If we want to think of ourselves as humanists, as people who champion the dignity of every person on this planet, who hold other lives to be as precious to us, as important as our own, then we have to take responsibility for eradicating racism. Now, society is difficult to change. Every activist who has genuinely worked hard to change their school, to change a law, to change the culture, knows this. You can work for years and see no practical results at all. But once in a very long while, the stars align. The right combination of social conditions, the right people, the right trigger come together. And a pressure point is formed, a social moment at which, if we push hard enough, structures of oppression will bend, then buckle, then break. Selma, which activists from Ferguson and around the country remembered with a pilgrimage last week, was such a moment. Stonewall was such a moment. And I'm here to tell you today that Ferguson is such a moment. Now is such a moment. The Black Lives Matter movement, which began on the streets of the suburb of St. Louis, marks a rare cultural opportunity in which we might, if we act together, advance the cause of common human dignity. And I believe our generation has been waiting for a moment like this. There's a lot of talk amongst media pundits and commentators about how millennials, and I'm just about a millennial, not as old as you think, college kids, are the most narcissistic, lazy, listless, purposelessness, useless generation ever. You read that everywhere. But I don't see that. When I look at people my age and younger, I see socially conscious, hardworking, creative, committed, politically engaged people who want to make a difference, but who sometimes aren't sure how they're supposed to do that. Well, this is a time when we can make a difference. We have in the last week seen the resignation of the Ferguson city manager and the police chief and the firing of the city's top court clerk. St. Louis forgave around 220,000 warrants after professions from activists for nonviolent municipal offenses. A Ferguson commission has been established to study the underlying social and economic conditions underscored by the unrest in the wake of the death of Michael Brown. And now, all across the country, whenever a person of color is killed by police, people take to the streets. And this didn't happen before. Most of the unnamed people of color killed by police, people of color killed by police, were anonymous, nameless, at least in the mainstream news, until this movement changed that. I said at the start of my talk, the very first action I went to was a vigil, remembering the lives of the many people of color who have been shot by police in the past few years. And I said that behind those speakers there's a banner on names, and I didn't know a single one. Well, now people are going to know the names. People are going to know the names of Michael Brown, Antonio Brown, and Anthony Hill. The movement has already shifted the register of the public debate about race. It's already making a difference. And we freethinkers can be a part of that. So I have a vision for you. A vision of the free thought movement and what we could become. To those of you who consider yourself freethinkers, I say this. We should be the ones who understand power and privilege the best. We shouldn't be arguing about whether racism exists, whether sexism is a thing, or whether homophobia is real. We should be focusing all our intellectual energy. Instead of hosting a debate, wow, that's exciting, I'm suddenly God. Instead of hosting a debate between William Lane Craig and Richard Dawkins, we put the same money and time into pulling together a panel of experts on prejudice and oppression to learn what we can do about it. What if, instead of wringing our hands about why there are so few people of color in our student groups, we got out there and marched alongside people of color in the streets? What if we free thinkers were known on campuses and local communities around the country as people who would stand up when oppression threatens their fellows? What if we became champions of dignity? Now, that would be a movement I would be excited to be part of. And now the opportunity has come right to your doorstep. As I'm sure you know, 1 week ago today, Tony Robinson, another unarmed black man, was shot and killed by a white police officer. Now the streets of Madison ring with the same chants that we began to hear months ago in St. Louis. Hands up, don't shoot! Hands up, don't shoot! The same slogans are on signs and t-shirts here as I've seen back home. The same energy is in the air. The same power is building. And around it, the structure of racism warps and buckles. Push hard enough now, and you can make a difference. In the words of one of those black mothers at the Mother to Mother event, we've created this society we now live in. This is our problem. The good people gotta stop hiding. Let's be the good people. Let's stop hiding. Let's be champions of dignity. Now's your chance. Take it. Now you probably have a million questions. But I'm done. We have like 5 minutes, right? Five minutes is plenty of time.
We have about 5 minutes. If you want to ask a question, there are microphones in the aisles. You can step up if you want to.
I'll try and be very quick. One-word answers. Oh, I answered everything that could possibly be asked about this topic. Excellent.
Our next speaker is going to ask a question.
Hello, next speaker. It's a privilege.
I just wanted to say that you have me in all sorts of tears. I'm very moved by everything that you told us this evening, and I heard that your solution is to listen. So if the marginalized group or I'm without words right now, I'm saving them for later, is telling us that there is a problem, that the solution is to listen to them and trust what they're saying. Any other solutions?
Well, I think that's part of a step into unraveling your own, like, the box that the culture has put around your own mind. And I really have to be totally honest with this. I'm not good at talking about these issues. I've become a lot better in the last few months. But I used to be one of those people who went to conferences and be like, well, I'm a humanist, and that means we should treat everyone as humans. And we shouldn't talk about race, because that's dividing people. I used to say that in conferences and stuff. Years ago, but I did say it. The first part, well, for me, it's difficult because not everyone have this experience. The first thing that helped me really come to terms with the nature of oppression is coming out of the closet and experiencing it myself. It sucks that not everyone gets to experience something like that, or does it? I'm not sure. I'm 50-50 on that. But listening is a first step, and then you take the lead and you do what people tell you to do. That was actually a very difficult thing for me. I like to be up at the front, standing and speaking at things. And a lot of the time I had to say, actually, this is not my moment to speak. This is my moment to turn up and just be there and do what people tell me to do. So listen, turn up, don't take over. That's a good three-step start. But I'm not an expert, I promise. I mean, this is just what I've tried to do over the last few months.
Mark, do you have a question?
Oh, yeah, go ahead, sir.
Do I need a microphone? Or if I talk loud, is that okay?
Is that on? Yes, okay. I have a question. I was arrested when I was 16. I was in jail down on Center Street with white people, Hispanic people, and black people. Most of us who were sitting in the cell were figuring out ways to bullshit the police about the fact that we hadn't really done what all of us had actually done. Most of it was drug-related stuff. We shouldn't have been in jail in the first place, of course, but we were. There's a word that has entered the popular parlance, you know, gaydar. Well, I guess, putting that word aside, how do you find a way when you're dealing with strangers, be they black, white, Hispanic, gay, straight, or whatever, how do you create a bullshit dar, meaning to know when people are lying to you? Meaning, I've met many strangers who've told me many things, and I just don't know when to believe it as a skeptic and when not to believe it, be they black, white, or Hispanic, or whatever.
I think I understand the question, which is, well, how do we, I see underneath your question, how do we know these people didn't do the things that they are being told that they did? We're being told that they did. And so I have to say, I think, and I've engaged in a lot of discussions like this, I actually think at this point that it's kind of irrelevant. I mean, it may be important for your own sense of personal safety or something like that in a particular situation, but the systemic problems are so broad and enormous that we're getting way more, I can't figure out the way to phrase this in my mind, we're getting way more false negatives than false positives. Is that a way to put it? Like, the system is totally broken. And I don't think that we should look at individual cases so much and say, well, maybe this one's okay, maybe that one's not okay, this person deserved to be shot, this person didn't deserve to be shot. Because the problem is way bigger than that. When we have a criminal justice system which is so manifestly unjust, we have to fix that system first. Then we can start talking about, you know, when it's really a fair system, I think we can get down to talking about who did what to whom. Because frankly, I've had my faith in the criminal justice system totally destroyed by this whole experience. I don't believe that it treats anybody fairly. And it it's heartbreaking to think that, because I didn't, I used to be one of those people. I like government and I like being a good citizen. And I like going up to police officers and say, hello, officer, thank you for your service. You know, I can't do that anymore because what I've seen really sickens me. And we've got such a big problem that I feel like let's fix that before getting to the question who did what to whom on an individual level. I'm not sure if that's a satisfactory answer, but that's how I feel right now. We have to move on.
Yes.
I will be around after this, but not. I'm going at 5:30 a.m. tomorrow morning. So if you want to ask me a question, please ask me tonight, because otherwise I won't be here. Thank you so much for your time.
Another round of applause for James.